Ah, spring. A new season has begun. And as the days grow longer, like so many math class boners, the dreams, they grow wetter. For April showers bring Austin Powers. Do I make you horny, baby? Season 3 will.
Hello and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. My guest this week is Nick Kroll, and you just heard the opening moments of Big Mouth Season 3, which just started streaming on Netflix earlier this month. I talked to Nick the Monday morning after that show went up, and he broke down some of the feedback he was already starting to receive from fans who binged the whole thing over the weekend. Since the movie Joker had come out that same weekend, I was curious to know what Nick thought about director Todd Phillips saying that he basically stopped making comedies because, quote, woke culture was making it too hard to be funny. To me, Big Mouth is the perfect example of why that is total nonsense, and I think Nick's response really helped explain why that's the case. Do you have ideas for comedians who you want to hear on the show? Please let us know by going on Apple Podcasts and leaving a rating and review and telling us who you want to hear. But now, let's hear my conversation with Nick Kroll.
Just
take your time.
Not catching up, just trying not to fall behind. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
All right.
I understand.
How's this? Is this okay? Do I need headphones?
If you would like them, they're right there for you.
I don't really need them.
Do you like hearing your own voice?
I hear my voice plenty.
More than you need to?
Yeah. before we even start, I'm just looking where my next thing is and what my timing is.
Oh, yeah.
Is.
Let me know.
How long do you normally go for?
We usually go an hour.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. I don't think I can go much past that because I have to be in Hollywood
I'll be mindful of the time.
Thanks. But an hour, I think, is fine.
Yeah. So what's your next thing? You have a pitch?
I have a pitch that I'm a part of.
Yeah.
Just a small part of.
Cool. Well, thanks for coming in and doing this.
Yeah, man.
It's an exciting Monday morning after Big Mouth dropped on Netflix.
Yes.
Do you get a lot of feedback? Do you pay attention to it? Do you take it all in?
I do. I mean, it's such a weird thing because it's so different than when I started all of this. Like, if someone said, like, even 5 years ago or let's say 10 years ago, mm-hmm. that I would work on a show for over a year. It would come out over one weekend. The entire show would come out.
Yep.
And then anyone who wanted to be in touch with you about the show, positively and negatively, could contact you in any number of platforms. It's a pretty surreal thing. So I both engage it and try to keep some distance from it because mm-hmm. it's just, no matter how positively everything comes in, it's weird. And I think it's hard for the brain to kind of absorb, you know, because you've sat with this thing, this show that, like, you know, basically me and my creative partners and writers and casts have been working on in different stages and forms for well, like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just gets put out into the world for, you know, hopefully millions of people to view.
Yeah. I think people are really excited about the show, the season 3 coming out. And then most people probably do finish it in the one weekend, or a lot of people do, I think.
Yeah.
Do you ever wish that it came out week to week and that you could kind of like put some space and people could have a conversation about each episode more? Or,
I mean, if I had my druthers, what I would tell people, and people have asked me, and there is something deeply gratifying about watching more than one episode at a time.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of wish people watched it like, there's 10 episodes in a season, like 3 sittings over a couple of weeks,
mm-hmm.
I think would be nice, you know, one episode here, 2 episodes there, 3, you know, I just think that, like, I think when you binge all of it and I'll take it however, you know, it's like, however people want to watch it, I'm mm-hmm. grateful for, people decide they want to watch the entire season, but I think that, like, stuff sticks with you a little more when you absorb it over a period of time versus like one, you know, bingey kind of experience. At least that's how I've that's how I seem to intake media and have it really resonate and sit with me. Sometimes, I mean, we had people this. I had a bunch of people this weekend being like, "I binged it and then I re-binged it again," and I'm like,
"That's a lot.
It's a lot."
But it is so dense with jokes that you can. I think it does. It rewards repeat viewing too.
I think so. Animation really lends itself to rewatching because there are so many different jokes happening on so many different layers, both visually and joke wise and storytelling, and that that I do think you can rewatch it and find new stuff every time.
Yeah. Well, I love the new season so much. I love the show. I got it a little early, so I did watch it probably over a couple weeks.
Oh, cool.
And think it's great. But I was looking back because I interviewed you for the Daily Beast before the first season came out.
Right.
And I talked to you a little bit about the audience for it and whether you thought that the kids, the age of the characters, would watch it.
What did I say?
And you kind of said, like, well, I'm not going to tell them to watch it, but you kind of hinted, like, maybe they would enjoy it or maybe they would get something out of it. And since then, there's been kind of all this, at least anecdotal evidence that I've heard from friends and people that kids are watching it. And these, you know, so it's the show's about seventh graders, and that's kind of, and that's the age group that we're talking about. And that they do love it and get a lot out of it and learn from it. So, I mean, what is your thought on that now? I mean, do you hear that?
I do. I hear it a lot. I mean, I have nieces and nephews, and I have, like, some of them are right in that sweet spot of, like, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, and obviously high school. Like, I assumed, it's so funny that because I'm like, oh, you probably interviewed me while I was, like, pacing around my kitchen.
It was on the phone.
Yeah, it was on the phone. So my gut is I was, like, walking around my kitchen, like jacked up on iced coffee, like doing five interviews, being like, I hope people watch the show.
Probably like the week before the first season came out.
Yeah, exactly. So, we have been more than pleasantly surprised about how many kids have watched it, and even more so that parents are okay with it, because it's obviously the show's very dirty, but like, I think more and more people are realizing that, like, with the messaging of what we're saying is I think trying to be pretty responsible where you know, but again, also like we are just an entertainment show, but having kids watch the show, nieces and nephews like texting me, DMing me, being like, my friends all watch the show, we're so excited, everyone loves it, like, and that's awesome because it is. Look, it's a show that we all made, and we're all very much adults, but we made it, and it's about this very lonely time in life and tricky time, and so the idea that kids would watch it and hopefully feel a little less alone inside of it and maybe learn a thing or two and have a laugh at it and be like, oh, I can laugh at this stuff, is very gratifying.
Yeah, so the season three starts in the spring of seventh grade for these characters, and I know you got picked up for six seasons, three more seasons, which is great. Congrats on that.
Thank you.
Have you thought about how these characters will age? Because there's this thing in animation where The Simpsons and you know, Family Guy, these kids stay the same age, but these kids, the nature of your show seems like they do need to grow a little bit. So how have you thought about that?
You know, it's a show about kids going through puberty and. Well, it started being like one of the reasons we wanted to do the show was because most coming of age shows, the kids hit puberty and age out quickly. So like I grew up with the Wonder Years and like Fred Savage hits puberty and like you're like, well, I can't really tell these like coming of age stories anymore because Fred is now an adult. So we were like, great, we can do animation. We can keep the kids young. But then as we're making it, the show is about kids changing and to not have them change and evolve and literally grow and emotionally grow would feel like it's a disservice to the subject matter. So we're aging them very slowly and we're pushing them through, like season three takes place in the spring, you know. The Valentine's Day special, which is technically the beginning of season three, is in February. And so we're slowly moving them forward. So we have a bit of a map as to where and how we think the kids grow and to what levels. But also, you know, we have a very clear idea of what we want to do in general, but we also do let the show and the characters and the stories like tell us what they want to be and try to listen to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of the episodes that I really enjoyed in the new season is the one where Nick gets addicted to his cell phone, Celsi, which is voiced by Chelsea Peretti, right?
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about why you wanted to make that part of it? Because that is such a big issue now, is like cell phone addiction, and with adults as well as with kids.
Well, it started with season three, I think, for us is a little more of an examination of what it's like to be a kid today. The first couple seasons were really more a bit of a nostalgic look back at Andrew and me and all of our friends and with the experiences we had growing up. And that stuff is still there, but we now... I think by season three, we're like, all right, let's start to get into what it's like now for kids. And, you know, the show is always taking place in the present tense, but it was minimal where we saw screens and things like that here and there. And the cell phone addiction stuff is obviously such a big deal for kids right now. Every kid I know has a phone. Every parent I know is trying to navigate and figure out how to deal with it, because it's like... It's a drug that's in your pocket. And I can speak from my experience of feeling very addicted and connected to my phone. I mean, it's like sitting here on the table as we do this interview, and I'm like, the energy off of it, and like, it's, to me, it's like vibrating energy constantly. Yeah. And I find myself really obsessed and addicted to it. And so it felt like we can talk about this because kids are really going through it, but also it's something that I can really connect with personally, of feeling like I've this weird emotional relationship. And then, you know, we were like, who could voice that? And my friend Chelsea Peretti, who's on the show already as Missy's mother and has played a number of other characters on the show, but as someone who I think has such a funny grasp over phones and social media, and you know, Chelsea's just got such a clear, distinctive voice, literally and metaphorically, in the space, that it felt like she would be a great person to voice the phone.
Yeah, she's great in the role. The other episode that I wanted to talk to you about is the Disclosure, the musical.
It's finally happening. We've waited so long. They've captured the magic and put it to song. Got to land apart, got to keep my composure, to be in the musical of the movie Disclosure.
All right, people, let's get started. Who's up first, please?
I'm Nick Birch, and I'm reading for the Michael Douglas role.
I'm a family man, not a sexual harasser. My boss tried to do me, now my life's a disaster. I only let her blow me, I did nothing wrong.
Wow, very loud, thank you.
Which I actually just listened to you on How Did This Get Made, talking about the original Disclosure movie with Demi Moore and Michael Douglas, which was really funny. Was that a movie that you thought about or watched at a young age that you connected to in some way?
I mean, it's part of that. There's a period of movies in the 90s, late 80s and 90s, where Michael Douglas was like what we like to say was too sexy for his own good. You know, there was Basic Instinct, Fatal Attraction, and then Disclosure was sort of the third in those movies. And Demi Moore had her run of like... what was the Robert Redford, Woody Harrelson movie?
I don't know.
Where it's like Robert Redford offers $1 million to Woody Harrelson.
Indecent Proposal.
Yeah. It was all in these like sexy sexual politics movies in the 90s. So it came together a few ways. One, we knew we wanted to do a musical episode, like that the kids put on a musical. So we knew we wanted to do that. We knew that all of this season was the first season that we wrote after Me Too had really taken hold and built momentum. And so we were like, we want to talk about sexual harassment. So we thought maybe, a musical sexual harassment. And then I sort of offhandedly said, like, you know, the bad example would be like they do a musical of the movie Disclosure. And then we were like, everyone sort of laughed, but then we were like, well, now let's try to figure out what the actual movie is. And we sort of, we went back to like look at other movies that were sort of are now problematic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh, maybe it's like Revenge of the Nerds or a movie like that that we all loved growing up. But then you now go back and watch and you're like 16 Candles.
Yeah, yeah.
These movies that you're now like, oh, these are tricky, but they just weren't quite as funny or didn't quite make sense.
It's almost, those are like two on the nose.
Yeah.
This is a little more left field.
Yeah. And Disclosure really speaks to 25 years later, a lot of what there is a lot of talk of, which is the paranoia of women using, weaponizing sexual harassment. But within that episode, so there's that play and there's all that stuff. But within that episode, my actual favorite stuff in there is the Lola Mr. Lizer relationship, which I think really speaks to so much of what really happens that is very gray and weird and gaslighty and people using their power to do something that's inappropriate and maybe like just weird gray areas. I mean, not gray, it's black and white. Like a teacher should never make a student feel like she has to do anything that she doesn't want to do or and then gaslight her for feeling crazy about it.
But he makes her feel like it's gray maybe or he
it's just a mess. That's this stuff is a mess. And so we just thought it was funny, and then like you go back and watch Disclosure and it's so 90s. Every piece of the clothing is so blousy. Demi Moore is she's great in the movie, but the character is so flawed and it's so like through the white, so through the male gaze, the whole thing. And anyway, so that was sort of, it just came together. It's one of my favorite episodes. And then the other side of that episode is Queer Eye.
Yeah.
It's like we got the Queer Eye guys to Queer Eye makeover Coach Steve.
Yeah. Coach Steve, I think this season really hits a new level. I think he's my new favorite character on the show.
Sorry, I'm drinking iced coffee while we do this. But he'd gotten fired in season two, so he now sort of pops up in these weird moments and clips throughout episodes. And, you know, he's a very fun kind of garnish to moments.
Yeah, I think his riff on Uber driving made me laugh harder than anything in a while.
Oh, good.
Over the credits of one
episode. Good. Yeah, that was just me in a booth venting a bit on my experiences with Uber drivers.
Do you voice so many characters on this show? Is there one that you've kind of gravitated towards, or one that you enjoy doing more than others at this point? Or
no, I really love. I always had the same answer for Kroll Show. It's kind of the same. It's really whatever character I'm doing at the time. I mean, the most. Nick, the character of Nick, which is me, is slightly the most challenging because he's like Coach Steve or Lola or the Hormone Monsters that I do, like they're, you kind of can immediately fall into what their point of view is or what the jokes are that they do. Nick is trickier because he's me and in some capacity, and so it's a little more nuanced. And I think, we're continuing to find new interesting things to deal with him. But he's, him and Andrew and specifically him this season, Nick is sort of a driving force through the season. And so sometimes like being the lead of a thing is not the most fun because you're carrying story and you're a little more reactive to the funny characters like Coach Steve. I'm really enjoying more the further we get into like a character like Lola and the more that she becomes less of just like the more that I can like get into the underlying psychology of her and give her more to do, like in that Lizer, that Disclosure episode where you really see how a poor girl like Lola, who's just like so happy to get the attention of a teacher and then gets caught up in something that she doesn't even quite understand and is quite innocent inside of it, I think is really fun colors to play with. But I kind of love them. They're all like my – it sounds so cheesy, but they're all my babies. I love them all equally and for different reasons.
So you tweeted out a review of the show, and I read it, and this quote really caught my eye. This is from the Vogue review by Emma Spector. Quote, it's refreshing to see a show made by adults tackle the complex question of sexual fluidity with humor that isn't derived from a hacky, cynical angle of aren't these kids crazy with their non-binary pronouns?
Uh-huh.
And it reminded me of, and maybe this just because I just saw Joker last night,
uh-huh.
of this Todd Phillips controversy. Uh-huh. Which I don't know, have you followed that at all?
Where he, lightly.
Yeah, so he basically said he used to make comedies like The Hangover, and he stopped doing that because he thought it was like impossible to be funny now that in this woke culture.
Right.
And your show, Big Mouth, feels like it's like the perfect example of why that's not true.
Mm.
Because you are able to be really funny in this and deal with these issues, and I think that review speaks to that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just curious if you think about that or what your kind of reaction is to that idea.
You know, it's I will preface it by saying, like, you know, I mean, here we are on a podcast talking about comedy, like so I'm like, part of me is just like, I don't know about weighing in on any of this. Mm-hmm. Like, I just kind of want, like, what I will say is, like, I think that you can still talk about anything and be crazy and not feel too censored. And, like, it's a trickier time. But also, like, you know, it's like we have a show where, like, a boy sends a dick pic to his cousin that he made out with. Like, mm-hmm. you can still do and say some pretty crazy, wild shit.
Yeah.
You know? But everybody approaches comedy differently and has different objectives and opinions inside of it. And, you know, and we don't always get it exactly right. And, like, there are people who are not always thrilled with how we're speaking about an issue, and I'm of the opinion, personally, I can't speak for anyone else, however they want to do comedy or whatever they want to say. I'm like, you know, we have this ability to listen and communicate with the audience and hear what they have to say, and sometimes I'm like, I don't agree with you, and other times I'm like, all right, yeah, I hear you. Like, we didn't get that exactly right. Like, we'll do better. Yeah. I'll try to do better. And I think, like, I'm personally interested in, like I went to the Galapagos last year.
Mm-hmm.
And like, the Galapagos is this amazing place where you see all these animals that have evolved separately inside of their own islands, right? That's mm-hmm. the basic idea of it. And it's this incredible examples of how creatures evolved and adapt in their own spaces, and you can watch them because they all have their own islands. And I was struck by just the creatures that survive are the ones that adapt.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, a iguana that can figure out how to grow a tail back after a bird bites its tail off, like, that's the iguana, their progeny are the ones that live on.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, you know, I'm here to evolve and adapt. And you know, everybody goes and makes their own art and however they want to do yeah. it. God bless them. And if they stop making it because it's not the way they want to do it anymore, you know, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to change or they want to complain and that's what their art is, then, you know, go ahead.
Yeah. Is there an example of something from the first couple seasons maybe that you got feedback on in Big Mouth that you said, oh, maybe that was the wrong way to approach that?
Yeah, like, you know, season one, I think we had a thing, Totally Gay. It's a song, and in it we had Freddie Mercury, and we, you know, Freddie Mercury says he was gay, and we got feedback from the audience that a lot of people were like, Freddie Mercury was actually considered himself or was really more bisexual, mm-hmm. and like, we then I think it's season two, we were like, okay, we correct ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're like, Freddie Mercury was considered himself or was considered bisexual. We are currently, there are things happening in this season that people are like, you have not classified this how we want to classify this. And, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm listening to what you have to say, and mm-hmm. and we will try to do better. And like, And to have a show that is talking about so much of this stuff, and I think so much of it is super important to people about their sexual identity and gender identity and all these things, like we're not going to always get it right, you know, and like and all I can say to the people who feel like either hurt or not seen, that like, you know, we are reading what you're saying and we are aspiring to get it right and have people feel like they're being represented, and that's like kind of all we can do. And I mean, it's this amazing, as we started talking about the episode, about like the feedback that is now readily available to us as creators, and the audience can weigh in and say like, we love this, we don't like this, this doesn't feel right, this feels like you understand me, this doesn't feel like you're seeing me at all. And then it's our, you know, we're in a position where we can either be like, okay, like either get angry or get defensive or listen and read and try to, like, going forward, like, be better at it, you know, but also be like, we're trying to be inclusive and trying to tell different kinds of stories. And that's like, you know, any of us can do is just like try.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have Ali Wong as a pansexual character in this season,
right,
which is exciting.
Ali, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay, I play soccer. I'm a Ravenclaw. And not to make all you normies shit your Old Navy undies, but I am pansexual.
Holy shit!
Jinx! Robert Durst! Kill them all, of course.
Okay, Aiden says she got kicked out of their school because she made out with a nun.
Hi, Nick Birch, Gryffindor. The pansexual thing sounds intriguing. Could you speak to that some more?
I'm not sure I'm ready to unravel all of this in my classroom.
Pansexual means I'm into boys, girls, and everyone in between.
I thought that was bisexual.
No, bisexuality is so binary.
It's pronounced bonery.
Not so sure about that.
You know, like when I see those ads for real estate couples on benches, it makes me real bonery in my pants.
Ugh, no. Being pansexual means my sexual preference isn't limited by gender identity.
And gender is like male or female, right? And it's a choice? No? How do people talk these days?
Oh my god. Okay, it's like some of you borings like tacos, and some of you like burritos. And if you're bisexual, you like tacos and burritos.
Oh my god, I'm fucking hungry now.
But I'm saying I like tacos and burritos, and I could be into a taco that was born a burrito, sure, okay, or a burrito that's transitioning into a taco, comprende?
Okay.
And honey, anything else on the fucking menu?
I was really just looking for a quick curse-free intro here.
There's people who I think on social media have been like, your definitions of pansexual and bisexual are not how we see it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a couple things within that. I'm like, well, it's a 13-year-old girl who's like claiming her identity, mm-hmm. but like a lot of 13-year-olds and like a lot of people on our show, they're saying whatever. It's not the truth.
Yeah.
But it's just like, it's someone who's trying to figure out their identity and posturing as they know what's what.
Mm-hmm.
But people who are watching the show feeling like we're not representing what bisexuality is or pansexuality is to them, I'm like, all right, maybe we didn't get it exactly right, and I will, like, we are reading and listening to you and like and hoping to you know, get it right, but also being like, we're trying to talk about these things and we're not going to always get it right, and also that our characters are kids who aren't authorities on anything. They're similarly trying to figure it out, and sometimes they are not, we're not saying like they are defining what these things are. They're just trying to understand it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that's what's so great about knowing that you have at least three more seasons to deal with this stuff, because you can kind of have the confidence to know that you have the real estate moving forward.
I hope so. Our goal is really, like, my goal is to like really continue to talk about all these different kinds of stories and make people feel like their story is being seen. And it's going to take time to tell all these different stories and let these characters evolve. And also, you know, when we don't get it exactly, when we don't get it right, that we'll like try to figure out how to get it right over time, you know?
Yeah. So you also announced that you have a Big Mouth spinoff happening, right? Human resources. Is that
correct?
Is that what can you share about that news?
So, you know, we on Big Mouth at the end of season two, the kids go up into the world of the monsters, the Department of Puberty, which is all in the sort of this world of human resources. And the more we thought about it, the more we realized how rich that world would be. So it's a show that is a workplace comedy set in the world of the monsters. You know, the hormone monsters, but also the shame wizards, the depression kiddies, the DN apes, all of the elements and characters and emotions and the things that sort of manage who we are as people.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Big Mouth really is focused on kids going through puberty and adolescence, this show really will allow us to go off and tell other stories in people's the broader landscape of a life lived, of birth and death and divorce, marriage, you know, and everything in between. And so we're going to, you know, write this next season of, you know, we're it's a long process. Mm-hmm. It'll take a while for us to actually put the show out because we obviously have a lot more work to do on Big Mouth, but we're starting the process of moving forward, and I'm really excited about it. I think it has like the potential to have like quite big, broad strokes and macro and micro stories to tell. But it really it's a workplace comedy show in the vein of The Office or all the other shows that sort of are workplace comedies about these hormone monsters, but then we'll be going down into the world of and to tell all these other kinds of human stories.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Coming up, Nick talks about getting back out on the road for his biggest stand-up tour ever. So you have also been out on a stand-up tour, the Middle-Aged Boy tour.
Mm-hmm.
So how's that been going? This is sort of one of the bigger stand-up tours that you've done in a while, right?
I think it's kind of the biggest, most kind of concerted effort of a tour I've done ever, I think. Like, you know, I put out a special like almost 10 years ago, 9 or 10 years ago, called Thank You, Very Cool. And it was stand-up and
there's a lot of characters, though, right?
And a lot of characters, and it really became sort of a backdoor pilot for Kroll Show. Mm. And then I've done stand-up over the years, but mainly, like, in L.A. when I'm around. And I've done some smaller tours or, you know, dates around the country, you know, on my own to promote Kroll Show or with the Oddball tour a few years ago. But this is the most, like, I'm going out on the road and I'm doing this hour and I'm, you know, really kind of working on it. It's been really fun. And it's been, I'm trying to take some of the lessons I've learned from Big Mouth, which is, you know, I feel like audiences with Big Mouth have really been drawn to the fact that it's very, a lot of comedy, but that there's a lot of heartwarming, but really like I've been much more vulnerable in Big Mouth, and I'm trying to take that across to my stand-up and being a little more personal and a little more revelatory about my life and where I am. And I mean, the name of the tour being Middle-Aged Boy is sort of speaks to this feeling of like, here I am, I'm 41 years old, but there's still a lot of elements to my life that, you know, I'm very much an adult, but there are still elements to my life that are kind of boyish. And I think I was interested in exploring that, and the material kind of lives in that space. And is, I mean, it's silly and crazy and goofy, like what I find funny, but also kind of opening myself up and talking a little bit more personally about who I am and the things that are going on in my life that I want to be a little more honest and vulnerable with audiences. And you know, it seems like people have liked that element of it, that it's a little more, you know, digging in a little more.
Why are we so mean to our moms? Like, why are we so
And everyone's like, I'm not mean to my mom. Okay, have you ever been with a friend and they get a phone call and they're like, it's the fifth time, I gotta take it, you know? Hello? Yes. Yeah, correct. I don't know, you could just text me this. I don't care that you want to hear my voice. Goodbye. They were on the phone with their mother, okay? Because we have no shorter fuse with anyone in our lives than we do with our mothers. I could be on the, like, I could meet David Duke. Like, you know, like, the grand wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and be more patient with him than I would my own mother. I'd be like, oh, uh-huh. And you don't wear the hoods anymore. You're just... And you're a nonprofit. Wow, I did not know that. Meanwhile, my mom could be like, I clipped an article for you about the LA Art Deco movement. And I'd be like, why would you do that, Mom? You know Art Deco is my least favorite architectural movement.
But it does seem like it is, yeah, more personal, and that it there's a contrast from the stand-up that you started out doing, which was more doing characters.
Yeah.
So how did you first start doing stand-up, and was that really the focus, is developing these characters at the beginning, or what were sort of the earliest?
I mean, my early days in New York, you know, I started doing improv in college, and I went to New York, and we started, like, I was doing kind of anything and everything. So it was like, I was doing improv classes at UCB, I was in a practice group, I was improvising with my friends from Georgetown in a group, but then I was doing open mics and doing stand-up. And then I started doing, you know, all these different kinds of weird shows in New York, alt spaces. And sometimes I was doing characters, and then I joined a sketch group, and I then got sick of doing sketch. So I started taking those characters and putting them live presentationally on stage, and then got really into that. And then still was sort of doing stand-up along the way, but it was usually sort of dependent on the character stuff. And I think it was because it was safer in some way to be like, well, I'm going to do this character. Like, I know this character's point of view, or I can hide behind it, mm-hmm. and be like an old Upper West Side guy, like, you know, oh, hello. Or I can be like a craft services coordinator like Fabrice. Or I can be like a Jersey Shore, like, douchebag, like Bobby Bottle Service, or blah, 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 you know, all those kinds, mm-hmm. of things. And which was great. And it's, I love doing characters. I love playing, doing different voices. And I love all that stuff. But as I've gotten older, I feel like, you know, I just feel like people are drawn to, when they're watching stand-up, they want to see someone's point of view on something. Mm-hmm. And I still fill the act with the character voices and act outs and things that I think, but it's usually in service of telling this story about myself. And I'm, you know, it's like just the challenge for me of trying to continuing to evolve. And if I'm going to go do stand up and I'm going to have a point of view on things, like, I want it to be authentic to who I am and where I am in my life.
Mm-hmm. What's sort of the origin story of the Oh Hello characters that you and John Mulaney developed? Because now they've gone through so much, including the Broadway run,
yeah.
recently. How did where was sort of the first time that you did that?
Well, we saw these guys. You know, John and I were always fascinated with this sort of got these kind of Upper West Side characters, both from living in New York and, you know, growing up watching like Woody Allen and that kind of style of movies, and, you know, Elliot Gould and that kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
We were in New York, and there were these two older guys walking through the Strand bookstore, and they were both buying their copies of Alan Alda's autobiography, Never Have Your Dog Stuffed. And we just followed them around and watched them read their book at a coffee shop. And so I was doing a a show with Jesse Klein at this place called Rafifi, which is now closed in New York, but was like a real hub for alt comedy in their early mid 2000s. And so Jesse got a job, moved to LA. And so John took over as my co-host, and we decided to host these shows as these two guys. And so we would just host the shows every week and interview our friends and eat, drink tunatinis and be idiots. And we just loved doing them. And we would just have fun making fun of our friends and coming up with bits every week. And then when I moved to LA and eventually got the Thank You Very Cool special, we thought it'd be fun to do the characters on that. We did that on the special. And then when I got Kroll Show, it felt like, well, let's have these guys be a part of Kroll Show. And we shot all different kinds of things, some of them more filmic, looking like a Woody Allen-ish movie. And then also like a silly cable access prank show called Too Much Tuna, where we prank people too much tuna. And that was very fun, and people seemed to really like that. And that's when we had like 15-year-old girls in Phoenix dressing up as these characters for Halloween. And we were all of a sudden like, oh, this is – because we were always told like, well, this is very niche. Right. Only like industry and New York people will get this and like this. And then once we saw all these other kinds of people getting into it, we were like, oh, this is something. And when I finished – the league was finished, or I maybe had one more season of the league, but I finished Kroll Show. I put it to bed, and John had just like Mulaney had just finished, and we were both like, what do we want to do? And we're like, well, let's maybe these guys, I think live play would be such a great thing. And we wrote it very hastily in LA, workshopped it a little, brought it to the Cherry Lane Theater in New York, a small off-Broadway theater, and then had so much fun doing the run, and then toured it, and then brought it back to Broadway. And, you know, I was just talking to John this past weekend, and we were reminiscing about it and like just thinking it was so fun. You know, doing stuff on your own is very gratifying and pleasing. Like doing the stand-up tour is really fun. But like doing something like that with, you know, someone who you're so close to and who's been my dear friend for so long, to then go off and have this experience together is incredibly gratifying.
Do these characters feel like they'll stay with you, you know, throughout your career? Do you feel like there's more to be done with them, or how do you think about that?
Our take is, you know, John and I both said, and we genuinely mean it, it's that I hope we'll be doing these characters until we're the age of the guys themselves. So
that would be great.
You know, it's the most fun. It's the most fun. It's the most fun, and again, to do it with a guy who I've, you know, known since college, who's so deeply funny and smart, is really like an incredible gift. Mm-hmm.
You cast him in your improv group, or what's
When I was a senior, I cast John and also Jacqueline Novak, who's got an amazing show right now up in New York called Get On Your Knees.
Yeah, unbelievable. I saw her work it out here in LA before she went there, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a great show. So to think that, like, you know, and I was in the group, and Mike Birbiglia invited me to audition for a sketch show and then join the improv group. And he and Ed Harrow and Brian Donovan, who are now writers in LA on a bunch of different shows, and Allison Becker, who's an amazing actress and writer and comedian here in LA, and all these people that I came up with, and John and Jacqueline, who were freshmen when I was a senior, and I knew immediately that both of them were these incredibly special voices. So to see now, however many years, like, you know, 15 years later, to see how incredibly funny and smart they are is like such a, you know, I'm just like, I'm like, I can't believe I got to work with these folks when they were kids, and to see now the world see how incredibly talented they are is cool.
Coming up, Nick tells the story of auditioning for SNL with John Mulaney, Jordan Peele, and Ellie Kemper. Only one of them made the cut. Yeah, so we talked about Kroll Show a little bit, but I wanted to ask sort of, that came up not long after you had auditioned for SNL, is that right? So you auditioned with John Mulaney at the same time as John Mulaney and Jordan Peele.
Yeah.
Which is just kind of insane because all three of you are unbelievable and have gone on to such great things, all on Big Mouth together.
I was writing the wrongs of no, I'm joking.
How do you feel about that that experience now? Has it made you I don't know, think about the show in any different way? SNL, just the experience of auditioning and then having them reject you and Jordan Peele.
I mean, so growing up, SNL was so important to me, and it still holds this weird power over all of us. Like, whether you watch the show or not, you're kind of always aware of who's being cast, and it does loom very large. And I think when I auditioned, I had done Cave Men, and I kind of knew everything was going to be okay. Like, you know, when you're young, and at that moment in time, it was a different moment in comedy when there weren't that many avenues to go do stuff. It was like, if I don't get SNL, my career might not happen. I knew if I didn't get SNL that things were going to be okay, that I was going to work. But I really, more than anything ever in my comedy life, I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live. And John and I were pitching a movie in LA. Before that, we both got a call being like, we want to audition you guys for SNL. And we like worked on our auditions together. And I, at that point, was like, well, I want to be on it. I don't think I want to be a writer. And John had written already a bunch and is such an incredibly talented writer and got cast as a writer, got hired as a writer on the show. And Jordan was in that audition. Ellie Kemper was in that audition. There are a bunch of people on that audition who have gone on to have very good careers. Obviously, Jordan, like, went and made Keen. So it was then I then got cast on The League a year or two later and then made Kroll Show a few years after that. So, like, it took me a little while to get to doing Kroll Show, but and Jordan and Keegan did Key and Peele, a similar time frame that I did Kroll Show. And it was very funny for us to both be like, wow, we've, you know, and there's something about SNL that I'll always wish I got on that show. Like, it'll just logically or illogically, it doesn't matter. It's just like, it's just got that hold. Even when I then got to go make my own sketch show on my terms, doing the characters I wanted to do without anyone else telling me what I could or couldn't do, in an environment that was entirely in my control, there was still that thing of being like, oh, but Saturday Night Live, you know? But it's all worked out.
Yeah,
it's all worked out just fine.
If would you want to host if that opportunity came up?
I would love to host that show.
Yeah, John's done it a couple times now.
Yes. Yeah, John, and he's done an amazing job. He's so perfect for that show and understands that show on all levels, having written there for so long. And I think, you know, so, but yeah, if you asked any person in comedy right now, like, would you, if given the opportunity, would you go host Saturday Night Live? Like, they would be lying if they said they didn't want to do it. Because it's just, it was such an important show to me. It's like, and I know so many people who are there now and the people who've come through that system, and there's a lot of very, very funny, talented people there.
Yeah, you've also worked a lot with Jenny Slate, who was there, and I'm not sure she had the best experience there, but
no, I think that I know plenty of people who've been on that show who it didn't work out for in one way or another and have gone on to have great careers, and other people who literally made their career starting there and have gone on to do other things. And I don't, you know, it's not to be a cast member or writer there, it's not for everyone, for sure, you know. Yeah.
From the outside, at least, it seemed like Kroll Show was just such a great, gave you kind of ultimate freedom in terms of what you were able to do. Did it feel that way while you were doing it?
It did. I mean, it was such a, I got to make a crazy show with all my friends, and Comedy Central was incredibly open to us making the kind of show we wanted to make. Because we didn't even want to make a typical sketch show. We wanted to make this hybrid, multi-narrative, multi-character show that kind of built off of itself and ate its own tail and evolved and changed and broke form and also like was really dependent on playing into other forms and genres of reality shows and other kinds of things. So it was incredible. And it was all the characters that I had been developing with, some of them with like John Daly and Jenny Slate, and being able to bring in like Jason Mantzoukas to do bits, or John Mulaney to do Oh Hello, and then interview them inside the show. And then, you know, John Levenstein, who ran that show, is such a special comedy brain, and bringing all the stuff that he wanted to do and try out and things. It was really an opportunity to do the things a lot of us knew we wouldn't be able to do elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And put it together. And John Kreisel, who directed it, who had done Tim and Eric and has gone on to do Baskets and Portlandia. And, you know, all these different kinds of shows. Like, it really was this opportunity. It was like a real, like, well, let's try it and see what it is. And let's take weird chances and do really weird meta inside stuff. And doing stuff with like Chelsea, and really being able to be like, have always loved Chelsea, and be able to work with her and give her the freedom to be as crazy and funny and sharp as she wants to be, and give, you know, let us play in that space together.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, myself included, were surprised when you decided to end it after three seasons. Mm. Was there sort of an overarching reason why you decided to end it?
There was a couple reasons. You know, because we had built this sort of meta cross-breeded world where characters and storylines started to meld, and, you know, different worlds started to enmesh. It was sort of like, it was not exactly like a Herald, but a long form improv where you have these different scenes, and that hopefully by and there's like three acts to it. And by the third act, you hope that all of these stories have combined into one cohesive story. It wasn't exactly that, but by the third season, all of these worlds started to enmesh and come together. And I felt like we had really explored a lot of those characters and storylines to their natural conclusion. And I was also just exhausted.
Yeah.
Because I had basically been doing The League, going from The League to Kroll Show and back, and then inside of that making a couple of movies and going on tours. And I just was physically exhausted and mentally a little drained. And I was like, I feel like we've told the stories we want to tell, and I think we can put this to bed. And I also wanted to open up my brain and physical time to start over and think about new things. And when I put Kroll Show to bed and took a back seat on the end of The League, and it opened up to what has become that run of what became the Oh Hello on Broadway and Big Mouth, which have been incredibly gratifying on a lot of levels. And I don't think I could have done either of those things had I continued on making more seasons of Kroll Show.
Yeah, yeah. So what I want to do now before we wrap up is kind of go through a few other of your credits that we didn't get a chance to talk about, and just see if there's a story or memory that kind of jumps out. Mm-hmm. I saw that one of your earliest writing gigs was on Chappelle's Show.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember from that?
Well, it was me and my Georgetown buddies, all the improv guys from there, Ed and Birbiglia, and my friend Conrad Mulcahy, who's no longer in comedy, and Brian Donovan. I was friends with Neil Brennan, and he was like, if you have sketch ideas, let us know. And we pitched them a bunch of ideas. And the sketch that we sold them ultimately was the white family whose last name is spelled N-I-G-G-A-R, which they then turned into like a kind of Leave It to Beaver.
Mm-hmm.
And we pitched some other stuff, but that was the one thing they really bought. It was an amazing thing to early on, especially when Chappelle's Show was so important that we had any version of a credit there was, you know, was awesome.
Morning, niggas!
Why, it's Clifton, our colored milk man.
And it's my favorite family to deliver milk to. The niggas. Something sure smells good. You niggas cooking?
We sure are.
The
some leftover bacon if you'd like some.
Ooh, not for me. I know better than to get between a nigga and their paw. Might get my fingers bit. Here you go. I hate to bother you about this, but, well, you didn't pay your bill last week. And I know how forgetful you niggas are when it comes to paying bills.
Golly, Clifton, it slipped my mind. Here you go. Sorry about that.
Oh, nigga, please. Nigga, please.
Few years later, you took your character El Chupacabra to Reno 911.
Yeah.
Was that a big kind of opportunity at the time?
Yeah, it was so exciting. I mean, I had watched Reno 911, especially like as a guy just getting started in comedy. I was such a nerd for the state and, you know, Tom Lennon and Ben Grant and all of the folks on and Carrie and all the and then all the people they brought into that show. I love that show, and that was a big deal to like get on that show and be able to improvise and play with them and feel like I could keep up was so exciting. And the idea that like those guys who I had watched when I mean they were young, but I was like in high school and college, that they were like, "Hey, come mess around with us," was like was incredibly exciting.
Hmm. Was there a first movie role that you felt like you really got to be funny in a movie?
I mean, the early movies I was in I Love You, Man, a little scene with a couple little scenes with me and Aziz and Rudd, and that was really cool. Date Night, I have a brief scene where I'm the like asshole mater D for Steve Carell and Tina Fey, and I got to kind of improvise and add a couple things in there. And that was really exciting because I was just looking at, like, at that moment, Liz Lemon and Michael Scott. Yeah. I mean, they are so much more than that, but it was like I was got to play with those two. It was really cool. Get him to the Greek then with Jonah and Russell Brand and Diddy, and getting to improvise in that sort of world was so cool. You know, it's like all these little one scene in a movie, but feeling like, you know, I was like, I had fulfilled my dream. I was like in a big studio comedy and got to mess around, and it was really fun.
You were on Parks and Rec a bunch with Matt Besser.
Yes.
As a duo.
Crazy Ira and the Douche.
Yeah. Hey, Liz, before we go, can you just do our tag? The only douche I let clean my douche is the douche.
How do I do it?
You say, the only douche that I let clean my douche is the douche.
I don't know if I want to.
Well, then it's into the spank chair.
Oh. Spank, oh. Chair. Spank, spank chair. Spank chair. Spank chair. Spank chair. Spank chair.
Oh. The only douche that I let use my is the douche.
Almost.
Beyonce didn't have a problem with that one.
So was that fun to get to work with him, one of the UCB founders?
All those UCB folks, like, you know, were that the reason I really fell in love with comedy was taking classes at UCB and doing workshops when I was still in college, and being able to play with him was super cool. And it's so funny now, Parks and Rec is now like on Netflix, and all those shows that we all loved and were so excited to be a part of when they were on, but not everybody in the country saw them. But now that they're on Netflix and Hulu or wherever they're streaming, people, like all new generations of kids, are watching it and are digging it. It's funny to all of a sudden be like, oh my God, you're the douche. I was like, I was on that show like 7 years ago, but I'm psyched you're watching it now.
Yeah. We didn't get to talk much about The League, but that's a show that I love and I know so many people do. Is there a story or when you think about your time, you know, you spent a long time on that show.
Yeah.
Is there something that stands out or just a memory?
Oh, man. I mean, there's so many. It's like, you know, I got to spend 7 seasons with that group of people, and it was such a funny group of people. And, you know, some of us were from the same world. Some of us, like me and Paul Scheer and Mandzukas, all came out of the improv world, but everybody else was from different spaces. And, you know, we all came together on that show and became really good friends. And we just all got together in Austin, and it was so fun being back together with everyone. I'm trying to think, I don't know, there's so many stories, honestly. Like, you know, obviously the stuff with Mantzoukas and I as Rafi stands out as so fun. There's an outtake of him realizing that Whitney Houston is dead, and then that Michael Jackson's dead, and you watch me truly not being able to keep a straight face, and I like have to leave the room for him to do his side of the coverage.
All right. Well, I brought you here for a reason. It's scrote season.
Oh, man, you guys do such fun stuff together. I want to hang out and, like, hit each other in the dick and stuff.
Well, it's not going to happen. I'm trying to protect my balls, okay? I'm hoping that you can help me.
Yes, I will be your ballsy guard. From now on, I'm Kevin Costner. Your balls are Whitney Houston.
R.I.P.
R.I.P. Whitney Houston?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Whitney's dead?
Yeah.
Oh, how's Michael Jackson taking it?
Oh, buddy.
But, yeah, that's... Yeah, I mean, it was like 4 months every year. It was like we got to go to camp. Mm-hmm. It was like going to camp every year with the same group of people. You're like, oh, we have 4 years of this, four months every year that I get to spend with this lovely group of people who I love.
And it was almost...
And, oh, the other thing I will say is the fun little fact is on Big Mouth, Jay's brothers are Shear and Mark Duplass.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're always doing these kind of like mini league reunions inside of Big Mouth.
Yeah, I love that. And then the last one that I wanted to touch on is a movie that I got to see at South by Southwest this year, Olympic Dreams.
Yeah.
Which I thought was really incredible.
Thank
movie,
you.
And just really special. So what can you kind of share about that experience?
It's this movie, Olympic Dreams, that I made with this filmmaker couple, Alexi Pappas and Jeremy Teicher. And Alexi's a summer Olympian. She's a long-distance runner. And the Olympic Committee gave them an artist-in-residence grant to go to the Winter Olympics to make something. And they brought me this idea for a movie, and I worked on it with them, and we built this script very loose improvised storyline that we then went inside of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang in South Korea last year and shot a movie, just the three of us with no crew. And the other actors, it's me and Alexi, and then the other actors are all real Olympic athletes, including Gus Kenworthy, who's now on American Horror Story, and a bunch of other really interesting athletes who, you know, lent us their time. And we just got this inside look at the Olympics in a way that I don't know if anyone's ever really been able to. It doesn't feel like you've ever quite seen the Olympics this way.
It's
like
a fascinating movie. Yeah.
It's usually pretty managed and polished. And here we are inside of the athletes' lounge and the med center and the dorms. And you really get a sense of, because of how small the movie is, of what it's like inside of the Olympics. And yet it's so grand because the backdrop is this huge world event. So I'm really excited for people to see it. I think the movie's really...
Can people see it yet? Or
it'll be out. IFC is releasing it in the new year. IFC bought it, and it'll be out in the new year. I don't know exactly the date, but it'll be in 2020, early in the year. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited. The other thing I'll just drop, because I assume this is coming out soon, is The Addams Family.
Mm-hmm.
I play Uncle Fester. In the Addams Family, an animated movie. I think that comes out October 11th. And it's very fun, and it's got a great cast. Charlize Theron and Oscar Isaac and Chloe Grace Moritz and Finn Wolfhard and Snoop Dogg and a bunch of other funny, talented people. It's like a, you know, I love doing the animated movies with kids and stuff. And I think this one's actually pretty funny and weird. It's much weirder than your average, like, kids animated movie.
And this one even younger kids can watch than Big Mouth. So
oh yeah. Yes, younger kids can watch. But I think it's one also that like a comedy adult parents who want to go see it. It's pretty funny and weird and dark.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
So then we end every episode by asking comedians, what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? So you can think about it kind of like a recommendation for something you saw on TV or movie or stand-up or really anything.
Well, on my tour, I'm having different people open for me. And the two openers that I've had recently, Emmy Blotnick, who is a great writer, I got to know because John Mulaney and I when we hosted the Spirit Awards. She was a writer for us both of those, and she's written for Colbert and ran the President Show. She's got a great album called Party Nights. She's super funny. And then I also recently had Langston Kerman open for me, who's really funny stand-up and actor and writer. He writes on Southside. He's currently on Bless This Mess on ABC, and has got a I think his album's called Light Skin Feelings. They're both stand-ups that I've been traveling with and opening. They've been opening for me, and they're both super funny. So I would go check out their stuff, yeah. Emmy Blotnick and Langston Kerman.
Check them out. All right. Well, thanks, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks again to Nick Kroll. Big Mouth Season 3 is streaming now on Netflix, and look out for the spin-off show Human Resources, which should hopefully be coming sometime next year. And if you want to see Nick on tour, you can find his stand-up dates and get tickets at nickkroll.com. If you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week!
I think we know the rest of the story.